All right, now we're live. This is our malpractice case number two podcast with Dr. Mark Leffler, oral maxillofacial surgeon. And so let's hop right into it. So this is the second case. What are we looking at today, Dr. Leffler?
Well, we're looking at a case of a patient who is medically compromised. He's in his late 60s, and he has a history of COPD, 35 years worth of smoking a pack or two a day. So if you do the math, it's probably 50-pack-year smoker. Conservatively, and he has a distinct fear of going to the dentist and having work done. And he's got a partial, maxillary partial in place for a long time, which he can't stand. So he goes to his dentist and says, look, I'd like to get rid of the partial. Is there anything that you can do in its stead? Based upon the bone configurations, or I should say lack, dentist suggested a couple of traditional fixed bridges. One would be a 5-unit, one would be a 3-unit. And, that would get rid of the need for a partial denture. So he expresses again his fear of dentistry and makes him anxious and ill at ease, et cetera. So the dentist says to him, well, we can do something about that. We can give you some anxiolytic, some anxiety reducing medication and nitrous oxide. And I'll make you feel comfortable, and then we can do our thing. So, if you want me to keep talking about the case, if you like, or if you have any questions to interject, just fire away.
Sure. Yeah. So it was nitrous.
Right.
So anxiolytic. Yeah. So benzodiazepine. Do we know which benzodiazepine?
Yeah, I do. I hate to give brand names, but let me just say it was a really commonly used benzodiazepine, 0.5 milligrams, which is not an especially high dose, I would say, orally given. So he comes in and the dentist had given him a prescription for it. He takes the medication, he says, roughly 30 to 40 minutes prior to actually sitting in the chair.
And just one quick pause. Was this at a general dentist office? Was this at a different dentist office? What was the setting here?
Sure. It was a general dentist who's a solo practitioner, had front desk staff and a couple of dental assistants.
Got it. So trained to give sedations on a...
That's the big bugaboo kind of. The dental assistant who was involved was not particularly trained. And that's being sort of kind. There was actually no training. The dentist, and it's very different by state. Some states require no particular training for what they'll call minimal sedation. Others do require some training, but it's usually not all that much. So in this particular dentist state, he was required to have a fairly short course. It was a 3-day kind of over the weekend course before being able to give the medications that he gave, in his practice, and it wasn't a really frequent thing, but he wanted to have that tool in the shed available to him.
Of course. So weekend course, and now he's giving oral sedatives, but nothing IV.
Correct.
Okay.
So, and just parenthetically, states have, again, they're very, very different. So there's no one national standard. They've relaxed standards over the years. Even dentists who want to give parenteral sedation, as long as they call it minimal, and it's really hard to control, not every patient's the same, can have lesser training. But in this situation, what happened was the patient was seated in the chair. And I will just point out that while he did disclose a history of COPD on his initial paperwork, he did not answer the question, do you smoke? So the dentist still did not know if he was actively smoking, actually had not asked. Mm. So that's an unknown. But this guy's COPD was significant enough that he could not walk a flight of steps without getting out of breath. And he had a pulmonologist who said to him, basically, unless you lay off the cigarettes, this isn't going to improve. And it's only going to get worse over time. He was 67 years old at that time. So he's seated in the chair by a dental assistant who sees what the treatment plan was, confirmed with him that he had taken his oral sedative before coming in, and placed a nasal hood, dialed in nitrous and oxygen, 70% nitrous, 30% oxygen. That's what she did.
No dentist has seen this patient yet. Okay.
Not that day. That's correct. And had not written in his treatment plan, I don't know that anybody would, what specific percentages of nitrous and oxygen were planned for him. But The dental assistant took it upon herself based essentially upon what she had seen the dentist do in the past. There was no consultation with the dentist that day prior to doing that. So the dentist walks in the room a few minutes later, leaves the settings where they were, and starts talking to the patient, and he's very drowsy at that point. And the dentist goes ahead and gives local anesthesia, basically infiltrations because they were maxillary bridges that he was prepping for. And that was the plan that day: prep, impression, temporize, and have him come back subsequent for the further steps in the prostheses. So after a few minutes, the patient is really somnolent, and the dental assistant actually commented, "Wow, this is a sedated patient," something to that effect.
Yeah.
The dentist did not really make particular note of that, and he continued on his way to do the dentistry that was planned, and sees a few minutes down the road that he didn't like the color of the patient's lips. They started to get a little bit blue looking, and whether he thought of the word cyanotic, I don't know, but he just was not very happy with the way that the lips appeared. He did obviously make the connection between not enough oxygen going on. So he started talking loudly to the patient, who didn't respond. He stuck a periosteal elevator into the gingiva in a non-anesthetized area and got no response. And at that point, he became worried, asked one of his staff members to call 911, which they did. And EMS showed up a short while later. Nothing had been changed at that point. He was still on 70-30 nitrous oxygen.
Still.
And what is certainly important is that there was no pulse oximeter, no blood pressure cuffs, and there are no starting points. He didn't walk in, his blood pressure was taken, pulse rate taken. None of that happened. So we don't have baselines for any of that.
Yeah. We don't know what his oxygen saturation was when he came in office prior to coming in. We have no clue if he was even in the 90s to begin with.
In the oxygen
saturation. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So EMS comes, and they're a pretty experienced group of people who came in, and they just essentially pushed him out of the way, the dentist, and started working on the patient. It was a fairly sophisticated setup from the standpoint that they had all monitoring equipment with them. They also had a direct connection to the local hospital ER, and they consulted with an ER physician while they're working on the patient. But the first thing that they did was they seated the patient more upright. They dialed him up to 100% oxygen, placed a pulse oximeter. The immediate reading was 75%, got blood pressure and pulse readings, which by report were really not so bad off the charts. It was essentially the oxygenation that was the issue. Although, maybe you would expect to see an increase in pulse rate, but there was nothing that was really out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
So they took off the nasal hood, put on a full face mask attached to an ambu with a fresh flow of oxygen coming in so that they had the ability to deliver positive pressure oxygen in the event they thought that was needed. They immediately got him ready for transport and did transport him to the hospital. And he got to the hospital, and over time with medical intervention, I neglected to say that the EMS personnel were advised by the ER physician to give him a dose of flumazenil because the dentist said that he had given him a benzodiazepine. So they wanted to try or see if it would reverse some of those effects.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So certainly nothing to lose by it.
Yeah. Yeah. A quick question. From your experiences, would you have considered, if this was you in that situation, would you have considered flumazenil, giving that in the office while the patient was in the chair?
You mean when he initially started losing? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But EMS did give it to him while he was in the chair before transport.
Oh, they did?
Yes. But it was under the advice of the ER physician with whom they had been speaking by their telephonic setup, whatever that was. But they transported him to the hospital, got there okay. He was attended to in the emergency room. He did come out of his, we'll call it a hypoxic state, or reduced oxygen state. And he became, fully conscious. In you know, because they wanted to just make sure that he was okay, they decided to keep him in the hospital overnight, monitor him, and he was discharged the next day with basically no complications that arose in the hospital.
Very good.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the end of the medical / dental aspect of things. That's how the background played out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, of course, because we're talking about malpractice, there is a next step. And the next step was the patient, this is what usually happens. Patients sometimes will just say, I just want to leave that in the past. I don't want to revisit it. But friends, family members, everybody sticks their 2 cents in and says, oh, you know, maybe you should sue this guy because he didn't do right by you. So he did follow up with a couple of attorneys. He contacted them. And he got the same answer from both, which was essentially, and I don't want to trivialize it, but it was essentially a no harm, no foul kind of situation. He didn't suffer any injuries per se. He actually didn't even have out of pockets of any significance because he was well covered with insurance. Yeah. So that covered his hospitalization, the ambulance, the EMS staff involvement, all of that. And you know, he was able to leave, go about the rest of his life. What we don't know is whether he spoke to his primary care physician and pulmonologist, and they emphasized to him the need to get rid of the cigarettes if he hadn't already done so. Yeah. So, but he contacted lawyers. They said, no, because you really don't have any damages. You're okay. Yes, it was a scary event. It was a close call, but in the end, you're okay. Did they think that the dentist slipped up in a few ways? Perhaps, but they looked at it from the damages standpoint, and really there were none.
Yeah.
So one of those attorneys suggested to him, and he actually took them up on it, that if because the patient was clearly disturbed about the dentist's actions, especially when he learned about what had happened, particularly in the hospital, they made a recommendation that he might want to make a complaint to the state board. And that is exactly what he did. So let me take a little step to the side for a second about state board complaints versus malpractice suits.
Sure. And really quickly, can I pull this up? Is this on the website at all? Just so if viewers want to take a look, you know, while we're going through it.
I don't know that.
Was this in like one of the months of the, the case of the month?
It was, but I unfortunately don't have that. I don't have it in its final form.
Sure, no problem. Next case.
Yeah.
Email through and I can pull it up so that as we're going through it, I could pull up so people can read along too if they want. Yeah, next one.
Yeah, okay. So they'll just have to listen to my dulcet tones and we'll move on that way.
This has been very detailed and great though. So I don't think anyone's missing anything here. No, we're right where we want to be.
Okay. So difference between malpractice suits and board. So first, the commonality. It's becoming more and more frequent that when patients do sue their dentists, they might also file a complaint with the dental board. Mm. Sometimes that's instigated by their attorney, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's actually against the advice of their attorney. The reason that it's concerning when they're done together in concert is that usually lawsuits play out much longer in time than board complaints do. Usually the board complaint, they'll get moving on it fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And if the board comes down against the dentist and their findings, some judges might actually admit those board findings into evidence in the malpractice suit. That's not an across the board thing. You know, judges would make a determination based upon their discretion at the time as to whether they want to allow it in evidence and let a jury hear it. Obviously, if a board, state dental board, has come down against the dentist and sanctioned them, you can imagine the impact upon a jury. It's not just a paid expert at trial.
Yeah.
It's the state who is actually doing it. It's a significant effect. And we as defense attorneys would really fight hard to keep that out of evidence. But it's a potential there, and that's why it's concerning. The other issue is, now that's the kind of joined point, but the separate
issues.
Yeah, that's
issues, when it becomes a malpractice case and there were complaints filed. That's when that gets brought into the case. Got it. Yeah.
Sometimes, or it has the potential to.
Has potential,
but,
yeah.
Right. A malpractice case on its own, that's what you pay malpractice insurance for. If there's a finding against you by a jury or there is a settlement, That's what our job is at MedPro. If it's our insured dentist, we pay the fare. We pay the legal fees. We pay the judgment or settlement as long as it's within policy limits. Right. And that's it. So you're kind of done with it. Although sometimes there is always reporting to the National Practitioner Data Bank and the equivalent at a state whenever there's a payment made. But that's the malpractice suit. I think the worst thing is a board complaint. And although we will provide counsel for you to defend yourself in a board complaint, if you're fined, you're on your own, or otherwise sanctioned, you have to deal with that. And as I'll show in a minute, this dentist was sanctioned in a very significant way. And there's nothing we could do as a malpractice carrier to get rid of that. So that's why board complaints are pretty scary things when I look at it. Some dentists may not view them in the same scary light as they would a malpractice lawsuit against them.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So the board, and it was a very, I'll say it was an appropriate process. It wasn't slanted one way. There were multiple dentists on the board. They had their own counsel. The dentist was represented by his own counsel through his malpractice policy. That's counsel is provided. And they had an opportunity, both the dentist and his attorney, to present evidence, to make arguments, less formal than in a courtroom, but nevertheless, a formal setting. What the board found was they don't care about the end damages, as you would have to show in a malpractice lawsuit. They care about what you did and whether it comported with appropriate standards of care that they viewed to be the standards. And their big issues were, and it's probably you figured it out by this time, one, that the dental assistant, without the dentist even being in the room, took it upon herself to place the nitrous and oxygen mixture dialed up, regardless of whether it was the right number, just dialed up on her own by her own decision.
And no vitals, no monitoring.
Nothing.
Never saw the dentist yet. Yep.
Yeah. And the dentist compounded that himself by not even taking vitals or monitoring even after he came into the room. But in and of itself, they levied that against the dentist, not against the assistant, because they thought that it was on him. It was his obligation. Make sure your assistants don't go and do this kind of stuff. You know, you have to appropriately train them to do what you want them to do or not do, because it's got to be all in the best interests of the patient.
Right. And really quickly, and remind me, was this the state board? This was the state board, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And then have you seen, just a side thought, have you seen differences between states of the boards, like how they kind of react to such an instance?
Yeah.
Situation?
Very much. And even within a given state's board, well, I'll answer your question first. Yes, there are some states that tend to be more permissive and more allowing of errors in judgment that they see. Yeah. That, you know, but that's just a general trend. But within the state board itself, it's usually a group of dentists who rotate on a panel, much like in appellate courts, where an appellate court might have 20 judges, but they might rotate panels of three. Hmm. And it's kind of the same philosophy with dental boards. And you get who you get. You don't have a choice. And, you know, it might be a dentist who personally has no experience with sedation in his or her practice at all, yet they're going to be the ones who are deciding your fate effectively professionally.
Another a part two question to that. Yep. Without going into what state, I mean, unless we can, what state?
No. I can't do that. Yeah.
Sure. So, and that's fine. More importantly, could you give maybe a couple states that are generally more strict and some states that are much more lenient? You know what I mean? Because then viewers kind of put into picture in their situation.
Yeah. Well, at the risk of condemning of a few states, I will tell you that the state that I have the most experience with is the state of New York, which is a state that just in general tends to be a more liberal thinking state. I suppose you would call it that. And that reflects greatly on jury panels across the state, especially in some specific counties. Mm. But the dental board, I've always found, was very, very strict and very sticking by the letter of ideal dentistry law, so to speak. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I I can tell you that that has been my experience, that what I have seen personally in representing my own clients.
Yeah.
But by the same token, they are a little bit more open-minded in allowing attorney intervention in their earlier stages. Let the attorney feed you the information rather than forcing the dentist to actually do that. So that's that. My former law partner practices in an adjacent state. There, they are a little bit less, you know, hammering, if you will, on the strictness of how they view things. You know, again, I don't want to call out a particular state and give generalities, but suffice it to say, always assume that these people are going to, they're not your friend. They don't come to the door and want to have a friendship with you. They're there effectively as administrative law enforcement, kind of. Mm. They're there to protect the dental population. That the dental patient population as compared with the dentist. So they ultimately found that in addition to allowing the dental assistant the free rein that was allowed, which was not in this patient's best interest, clearly, then he also didn't have monitoring, as Brendan spoke with a lot. You spoke to that, and it's really important. No baseline. Even when things started to go bad, nothing. Simple reason, he did not have pulse oximeter in his office, which very surprising, but true. Wow. Yes.
Very surprising.
Yes. He did have.
Yeah. I was just going to say, he's administering nitrous. How does he not have a pulse ox?
Don't know
he's
the answer.
Oral sedatives that can cause respiratory depression potentially.
Yes. So, yeah. Don't know. It was not there at the time. Whether he had one, it broke, and he hadn't gotten around to getting a new one, I don't know the answer. But it was there. There was a blood pressure cuff available. He obviously could have taken, you know, pulse readings just by palpating a peripheral pulse if he wanted to, but none of that was done. He was pretty severely sanctioned for that. And what they did was they fined him. They required that, well, they immediately suspended whatever permit he had to deliver any type of sedation. That was immediately suspended. And he was required to take continuing education that they approved before he could even reapply for that. But I think the worst part of it was that they suspended him from practice for 6 months.
From entire dentistry practice?
Yes. So if you're part of a group,
that's a lot.
You could probably get over that hump. But what do? You're a solo practitioner and you are out of business for a period of 6 months. What do? What do you say to patients? You can't ethically lie to them. I mean, that would be a totally unethical thing. You can't say, oh, it was a medical problem, for example, that you had that put you out of commission for a while. You know, and it is published on board websites. So it's out there for the world to see should they choose to investigate it.
That seems a bit harsh to me. Oh. That seems really harsh to suspend someone from dentistry for 6 months. I mean, okay, CE credits, taking away their oral sedation license, whatever they call it, minimal or conscious sedation license. Right. I think that's fine. And then giving the provider a path to potentially getting that license again. Maybe they need to do a couple more courses. Maybe they got to wait 1 year or 6 months to re-get that. But to completely prevent this provider from seeing patients. Now patients are losing at that point, right? Because they can't see this dentist for a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
Unless they go to someone else that they're not comfortable with. He was giving oral sedation, so maybe they're very comfortable with this. He's seeing patients with high anxiety. That's an extremely strict board.
Yes, extremely. At least a strict group within that board that he just happened to have, you know, gotten the brunt of, you know, bad draw, so to speak. But you know, you don't pick your judges, and that's what these people were effectively functioning as. So we have to live with it, and we do see strict, very strict board actions. What I have personally seen much more frequently than a flat-out suspension is that they will suspend you for, say, 6 months, but stay all but a month or two of actual suspension. So in other words, the suspension sits on your record as being suspended for 6 months, but you only have to actually stay away from practice for whatever the period is, a month, 2 months, and then you can go back.
Oh, interesting. Or
they might require that you practice under the at least indirect or possibly direct supervision of another licensed dentist, which can be a tough go as well, because, you know, how do you get that if you're not part of a multi-practitioner practice?
Yeah. How would you do that? Were they able to practice in a month or two after, or they sat out the full 6 months?
This provider sat out the entire period. It's a practice killer. There's nothing short of it.
Yeah.
And which is why I kind of started out by saying, I'd much rather a client of mine be sued for malpractice than have a board action against them. Because in the end, the malpractice suit, what's it going to result in? Money would be paid, worst case scenario. It would be paid by us as the insurance company, but life goes on from a practice standpoint. Whereas with a board action, yeah, he was fined. The fine wasn't the big deal. The big deal was, wow, I can't practice now for 6 months. That's a very, very scary prospect and nothing that you could do about it. You might be wondering, and I'm wondering the same thing, what happened at the end of this 6 month period of time? Was he able to go back to practice? Did he have something to do? And I don't know the answer to that question. You know, it was not my client. I was not privy to any subsequent follow-up that perhaps his personal attorney was privy to.
Right.
Yeah.
Can we go through, just to rattle them off, or perhaps you have a list maybe of what happened in the state that the board looked at and said, you know, like the pulse ox, didn't even have a pulse ox in the office.
Mm-hmm.
No baseline blood pressure, oxygen saturation, vitals.
Mm-hmm.
Provider never saw the patient prior to administering nitrous. The assistant. So lack of training or experience or provision of the assistant, perhaps. Here's another thing, just a quick side note. How do you give some or tell someone to take an oral sedative or an oral, you know, anxiolytic or, you know, tardigrade amnesia or, you know, whatever it may be, but prior to them even coming to the office? What if they're like, you know, I just got really hungry. I'm not going to sleep, so I don't have to be NPO. Why don't I just stop by 7-Eleven real quick and get a Slurpee? And then they fall asleep in the, like, I'm very surprised that you could give oral sedatives to patients before they even come in the office like that. You know what I mean? In fact, there was a patient where a periodontist at NYU had given a patient an oral sedative. I forget which benzodiazepine it was, but you know, it was like 40 minutes on the subway. And then they were stepping out, patient was stepping out of the subway, slipped on the platform, completely like went blank, didn't even just fell, hit their head, ended up in the hospital, concussed. And that's not the first time it's happened. I'm just surprised. I don't know. I'm very surprised about this.
And, you know, if we want to start looking at physiology here for a bit, not to take off onto that too much, but, you know, a COPD patient, you know, what is their respiratory drive? Is it hypoxia or hypercapnia? And, you know, I think with most of us, I think we'd probably agree if we're healthy, it's hypercapnia that is our drive for respiration. Maybe some might disagree. In a COPD patient, it's probably the opposite. It's probably hypoxia that is the drive to breathe. Well, if you're feeding a patient 30% oxygen with the nitrous, you are hyperoxygenating them. So that takes away the drive alone or as a factor. You are giving a benzodiazepine, which is going to reduce respiratory drive, if you will, on its own, especially in an older patient. This guy was 67 years old. So if you put all of those factors together, he's not going to have the impetus to breathe. He might, quote unquote, forget to breathe, so to speak. And, you know, that needs to be taken into account as well.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't. I think what was clear, and I think the board was sending a large message that you can't just look at these medications, even nitrous, as candy. These are drugs. They have side effects. They need to be closely monitored. So you can't just willy-nilly say, here, go for it. Yeah. So, I mean, if their job is to protect the public, yeah, they were really strict. But, you know, I don't know that everybody would be disagreeing with their decision being as strict as it was.
Yeah, they definitely made an example of them.
That's for certainly, sure. Yes. And If I can take a blood pressure taking detour for a second, because it is related. A couple of years ago, the ADA provided a set of guidelines. Now, the ADA is very careful to say, we don't provide standard of care. And I appreciate that. They do put out guidelines, and they're simply that, and you could do with them what you will. But they distributed a guideline within the past couple of years that every patient who has a blood pressure of 160 over 100 or greater, either one, systolic, diastolic, should have an elective procedure deferred in favor of having a medical workup first to get the blood pressure under control. And the number goes up to 180 over 110 for urgent procedures. So you have that extra latitude. But if you think about it from a logical standpoint, how do you know if a patient has those elevated blood pressures, or if it is elevated, or if it's beyond that, without taking the blood pressure on every patient before every procedure? So that is now implied, at least according to that ADA guideline, that every patient has to have a blood pressure taken before every procedure is performed.
Right, sure.
Is that done? I would venture to say probably not in many practices. So if it's not done, are you falling shy of the standard of care? Well, you're falling shy of the guideline for sure, because you can't know the answer. And I would think that many experts, when they testify, will incorporate that guideline, if it's not directly allowed into evidence, that is the appropriate way to treat. So, you know, you're kind of starting off just behind the eight ball. If a patient has some cardiovascular, cardiorespiratory event, and you hadn't taken blood pressure to start with, you know, you have yourself a problem. So that's why those guidelines need to be watched and carefully abided by, at least in my view.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. In our residency program, when they have diastolic over 100, we usually defer any care because it's going to be surgical. You know, that can impair, it could prevent them, the bleeding from stopping after tooth is extracted, even if they're unhealthy, other medical conditions. But there was a patient that I had in the urgent care clinic. It was 181 over 107. And they needed like maybe a couple teeth removed, right? This is a year ago or something. And I had put out a post on it, and a bunch of anesthesiologists and CRNAs and emergency room doctors hopped in the comment section and was just saying, oh, you don't know how to manage blood pressure. This isn't an emergency. And all I said was, we're just delaying that this is an emergency, but we're not doing, you know, and I didn't say I was sending them to the ED, although some attendings would send a patient to the ED if the diastolic's over 100. But, and you know, in dentistry and oral surgery, we're not managing people's blood pressure. We're making sure their blood pressure's in a safe spot for us to pursue, you know, to go ahead and do surgery. So it's very interesting. What I'm getting to is, you're saying different people on that board, you know, that group of the cards that you're dealt on that board, can definitely judge the provider based on just what their personality is, what their experiences are. And yeah, it can be very extreme.
Yeah. So. And, you know, there's another benefit to it. You know, dentists are often put to the side, not as being primary care providers. And we are. Dentists are certainly that. So if you add that into the mix, just think about the PR from the community standpoint. Suppose you take a patient's blood pressure before a procedure. They have no history of known hypertension. Yeah. You take their pressure. They're now 180 over 110. Wow, I didn't know that. So you have just assisted in the diagnosis of a patient's hypertension that they would not have otherwise known. And think about the benefit to that patient, and word spreads in a good way in that situation.
Oh, absolutely. It could save someone's life. It could prevent a stroke, but it could also get them on top of some blood pressure controlling medications by a primary doctor. And maybe they go and see that primary doctor, they get that, but they get other assessments and evaluations that find other comorbidities that they weren't aware of. Yeah. Oh, it's very essential. Yeah. I think we hit all the topics here, Dr. Lever. What do you think?
I think so. So happy to have hit those topics and maybe open up some eyes and maybe some eyebrows are raised, really? But yeah, in this world of malpractice, which is attached to board complaints, you do have to raise your eyebrows occasionally and say, yeah, really? Right. It's an unfortunate fact of professional life.
Oh, wait. We have a disclaimer, okay?
This podcast does not constitute legal or medical advice and should not be construed as rules for establishing a standard of care. Because the facts applicable to your situation may vary, or the laws applicable in your jurisdiction may differ, please contact your attorney or other professional advisors if you have any questions related to your legal or medical obligations, rights, state or federal laws, contract interpretation, or other legal questions. MedPro Group is the marketing name used to refer to insurance operations of the Medical Protective Company, Princeton Insurance Company, Plyco Inc., and MedPro RRG Risk Retention Group. All insurance products are administered by MedPro Group and underwritten by these and other Berkshire Hathaway affiliates, including National Fire and Marine Insurance Company. Product availability is based upon business and/or regulatory approval and may differ among companies. Thank you for listening.